Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Hello, listeners. This is Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland. This week on the Nerdcast, the White House is weighing all sorts of different policy proposals, new cuts to corporate taxes, payroll taxes, among other measures, to try and cushion the U.S. economy ahead of their worst fear heading into 2020, a recession that could damage Trump's reelection hopes. Plus, we're going to go inside President Trump's feud with one of his closest friends, or we should say former closest friends, and just how that fits into his administration's freewheeling policymaking. As always, we're taping this on Thursday. Today, that's August 22nd, so it's all up to date as of then. So in public, President Donald Trump and his administration are always talking about how great the economy is. This is one of their big selling points in general, also heading into re-election. But Politico White House reporter Nancy Cook, who's with us this week, found out some new information about what his administration is saying about the economy behind the scenes. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you had a big story this week that got behind the scenes with the White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, talking to Republican donors and sounding a different note than we're used to hearing about the economy.
Absolutely. So I would just say broadly, White House aides are very worried about an economic downturn. And that's sort of, you know, I talked to a bunch of people this week for the story. And, you know, while Trump is tweeting out very positive things, I think they are quite stressed out about this. And the campaign is as well heading into election. But one thing that I found very telling was the acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, was in Wyoming earlier this week, and he was speaking to a group of about 50 very high-end donors at a private home in Jackson, Wyoming, along with Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. And he was asked about the economy. You know, donors are wealthy people. They want to know what administration people think of the economy. And he said something very telling. He basically said, you know, the economy is doing fine now. The fundamentals look good. But if there was a recession, it would be moderate and short. And that was sort of one of the first indications that the administration is sort of you know, publicly admitting the possibility of a recession and then also trying to couch it as something that wouldn't be that bad. I mean, there's really, you know, moderate and short recession is sort of an oxymoron. You know, recession means that you have sort of two quarters of contraction. And so, you know, even that is almost, you know, half a year.
It's just funny that there's this kind of funny thing among like, political professionals about not even saying the word recession. It's like the R word, right? And the so it's always interesting to hear what happens behind the scenes when people are going through these talks. But meanwhile, as you said, President Trump in public is having none of this, right? He just tweeted this morning, the economy is doing really well, and then putting some pressure on the Federal Reserve. And he said the Federal Reserve can easily make it record setting. And so, you know, kind of trying to put pressure on one of the levers of the economy here. But there was a really interesting line in your story, Nancy, about some of the thinking behind this. And there is thinking behind it. You had a White House advisor saying people don't vote on numbers. They vote on whether they feel good. And the president understands that. He is selling the feeling. And it feels like Trump is almost trying to kind of guard against a potential economic downturn by basically sowing the seeds to like say that it doesn't count or it's not actually happening.
Exactly. I mean, I feel like Trump at this point views this as a messaging war. And so it's something where, you know, despite these emerging data points that show us that there is sort of an economic slowdown happening, there was some volatility in the bond market last week. You know, there were some revisions to the job numbers that showed that the last few months of job growth weren't as good as we originally thought. You know, the president is basically doubling down on this idea that the economy is great because he and his aides really understand that that is his best message heading into 2020. And what they're concerned about is so many suburban voters and voters basically say, you know, oh, we're willing to overlook potentially racist comments or incendiary remarks because the economy is good. And that justification for supporting Trump really goes away if the economy tanks. And they are very, very well aware of that. And so that's why I think Trump is sort of keeping insisting on Twitter in his gaggles with reporters, you know, sort of the Fox News propaganda machine. They are all insisting that everything is great and there's no troubled signs on the horizon. But what is so interesting to me is that White House aides behind the scenes are freaking out a little bit. You know, they're thinking about things that they could do, policy levers that they could pull to boost the economy. There was some discussion last week in the beginning of this week about potentially, you know, more tax cuts. But the thing is that they don't have that many policy levers left at this point. Basically, what they could do is ask the Federal Reserve to keep cutting interest rates, which is why we see Trump putting so much pressure on Jay Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve. But the other thing they could do is end this trade standoff with China, which really a lot of business groups think is very self-inflicted at this point. And Trump doesn't really want to do that. But I think that there's more and more pressure from business groups and heading into the G7 this week in France, where he's going to be meeting with world leaders and sort of talking about trade and global economics. There's more and more pressure on this idea that he has that we have to be tough on China and these tariffs, because that's really what is causing some of the slowdown in the U.S. Mm-hmm.
And so meanwhile, as the administration is thinking through ways, maybe apart from rethinking the tariffs to try and keep the economy moving, and Trump is making the argument that everything, at least for now, is fine, we're also seeing kind of on the sides of all this, the administration and Trump in particular, basically setting up the beginning of an argument about who he's going to blame.
Absolutely.
If the economy does take a downturn.
Absolutely. And I think that that is part of his idea that the whole thing on the economy is just winning the messaging war on it. Forget the actual numbers. And so, you know, this week we saw him and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich blame the media for the potential economic slowdown, saying that this was something that the media had, you know, cooked up. Trump has blamed Democrats. And then Trump has this ongoing obsession with the Federal Reserve Board Chair, Jay Powell, who was Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, really pushed Trump to pick him. And I think Trump has very much regretted it ever since then. And he has really tried to make Jay Powell a scapegoat. But I was talking to a former senior administration official yesterday who was like, I just don't think that's going to work. You know, does like your mom in Wisconsin care who Jay Powell is if she loses her job? I don't, you know, so I think that he's really setting up the Fed chair to take the blame if the economy goes south. I'm just not sure that like the Federal Reserve and what they do and who runs it resonates with a huge swath of the American public.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. One thing I was having this little like glimmer of a political science class I took in college many years ago about like how voters digest information about the economy, and I think there was some research at some point about that it's the way the economy affects voters is almost less about how their own pocketbooks are doing and their perceptions of how everyone is doing, you know, how their neighbors are doing, how their town is doing. You know, I wonder how something like that would combine with Trump going out and saying, actually, everything's fine if things started to turn down, or, you know, the administration finding a convenient scapegoat like that, and just how that would affect broader voter attitudes. I mean, we've seen time and time again that it's really tough to be an incumbent president or even just the incumbent president's party when the economy is having trouble. But, you know, obviously we're in a very different media environment than we've ever been before as well.
But I think you're right. I think that so much of the economics is based on people's perception. And right now, we haven't really seen like a hit, let's say, to consumer spending. We aren't seeing people who are stopping buying cars or houses. You know, we haven't seen those slowdowns.
It's the preliminary indicators, right?
Right.
That we're seeing at this point.
But I think that that is why Trump is doubling down on this very upbeat, happy talk message about the economy, because part of it is like you don't want people to start to get worried and then they don't buy a new refrigerator, or, you know, they don't take a vacation, you know, or they don't buy an expensive new car. You want people to keep doing those things. And we haven't really seen the slowdown in consumer spending. We've just seen the slowdown, let's say, in businesses that may not want to invest money because they're not sure what's going to happen with the trade war. But we haven't seen it on the consumer side. And I think that that's what Trump is trying to prevent.
And the effect we're seeing is just the effects of the big tax cut that Trump and congressional Republicans passed in 2017, kind of like rolling to an end at this point, right? That was a supposed to be like a big boost for business investment and things of that nature that maybe kind of ballooned a little bit, got through 2018, 2019, but now we're starting to see just the air.
Yeah, that bill passed in December 2017. So mm-hmm. that was a while ago now. And, you know, it's worked its way through the economy. And I think that, you know, it did really help corporations. It did help wealthy individuals disproportionately. But sort of that stimulus, that one-time economic boost is over now. And that's why I think the White House was floating these trial balloons about the tax cuts, which honestly are really just sort of talking points to show that they're doing something. There is no way that Congress right now is going to pass another tax cut. Tax bills originate in the House. The House is controlled by Democrats. Democrats are not going to go along with that. But I think that the White House really wanted to show that they were doing something. And so there was this talk of a potential payroll tax cut or another corporate tax cut. And that was, you know, the White House wanting to show, hey, we're looking at stuff. But meanwhile, as I talk to people, they're both fearful inside the White House, but there's also like no coherent strategy policy-wise on actually how to deal with it if there is a real downturn.
Got it. Well, Nancy, thanks so much for coming on Nerdcast to talk to us about it this week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Nerdcast will be right back after a short message.
Check out The Nation Magazine's new podcast, Next Left, hosted by National Affairs correspondent John Nichols. From the grassroots to the ballot box, we are witnessing an explosion of progressive political energy. New candidates are running for offices high and low, and they're winning. These insurgent politicians let us into their lives, tell us their stories, and explain how they plan to change our country for the better. These are people reshaping our politics by bringing bold, progressive policies to their cities, counties, and states, and to D.C. Join John Nichols every Tuesday for a new one-on-one interview like no other, and download the Next Left podcast from The Nation magazine or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, listeners. Next up this week, we've got another Politico White House reporter, Daniel Lipman, who's joining us for the first time ever on Nerdcast. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. So, Daniel, you wrote a piece that got a ton of attention this week about President Trump and one of his closest friends, or should I say closest former friends.
Frenemies.
Yeah. So Tom Barrack and Donald Trump have been friends and confidants for more than three decades. They're so close, for instance, that Barrack comforted Trump during the funeral of his father, Fred. He was Trump's inauguration chairman, and that actually gets to the root of the rift here. So, Daniel, you reported that this relationship is fractured so badly that the two no longer speak. So what happened?
So they used to speak multiple times a day, where Trump would call Barrack for advice and for counsel and just to catch up as friends. And what happened was there's been a series of stories in places like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times about how Barrack is under investigation for the inaugural committee. And there was tons of money raised. It was a record $107 million. And so and they didn't expect to win. And so it's not like they were planning for the, you know, verification to make sure that there were no foreign dollars spent. And it's the type of committee where, you know, this type of stuff in a regular campaign, there's a set limit of how much money you can usually donate. With the inaugural, if I wanted to give $1 million, I could. And so people were spending tons of money to buy access to Trump because they were worried that they could be on the receiving end of a tweet and of a trade policy that would go south for their company or industry.
So the inauguration became this huge influence, or at least allegedly a huge influence peddling operation, and there's reportedly federal investigations circling around that.
Yeah, so the usually we think about the Southern District of New York as investigating Trump world, but there is also the U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn, the Eastern District of New York, the EDNY, and they have been doing the most amount of work looking at the inauguration, whether there were foreigners who were giving money to straw donors in America to pass along to the inauguration. And so this could be, you know, the Qataris or the Saudis, you know, members of influence, you know, who are trying to influence Trump and get, you know, there was also foreign policy to think about. And so Barrack has had many ties to Middle Eastern leaders over the years. He's done tons of business. And he was also pursuing this nuclear deal where he was trying to get a cut of the sale of Westinghouse, which makes nuclear plants. And he was also lobbying the Trump administration at the same time, in the early days, to give them licenses to Saudi Arabia so they could share nuclear technology. And he didn't register under the Foreign Agent Registration Act, which is the same statute that got Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort and others in Trump world they had to plead guilty to those types of charges.
You know, it's interesting just thinking through the ramifications of this. And I was thinking, it's like, okay, like Trump has you know, cut off a friend. Why should we care? But like that, we've had so many administration officials, campaign officials come under investigation. Some of them have gone to jail, or you know, or could be sentenced to go to jail in the future. And then, but as you mentioned before, Barrack is part of this, like, I don't know what the term is, a kitchen cabinet, I guess, of just these friends and outside world advisors who Trump, as president, has continued to call up, as you said, in the past, sometimes numerous times in a day, to get feedback and ideas about, you know, what sort of thing he could be doing with the vast power of the federal government. And so the I think that kind of sets up the stakes very clearly then for when something like this evaporates and someone kind of gets ejected from that orbit.
Yeah, I also talked to one person close to the president that said that Barrack used to tell things to Trump that he didn't want to hear. And so if you've known a person for 30 years, you're more willing to say what's actually on your mind instead of saying, oh, Mr. President, you're doing a great job. Everything is going well. The economy is booming thanks to your amazing leadership. And Barrack has also stood out among Trump world people for sometimes criticizing the president in the media. So he told the Washington Post that Trump was better than this when talking about the Muslim ban and also our efforts at the border. And Barrack is Lebanese-American. He has a pretty interesting story of he's now a billionaire. He doesn't have tens of billions of dollars, but I was checking the rankings, and I think he's at least $1 billion. and he is a real estate venture capitalist, and he first met Trump when he helped sell the Plaza Hotel in New York to then businessman Donald Trump in the 80s. And that led them to strike this friendship. And they're similar ages, and so they've gone through divorces and, you know, the birth of kids together. So they've kind of they're kind of tight buddies until recently when Trump wanted to distance himself because of these investigations.
You've illustrated how close this relationship with Barrack was and the kind of influence he's brought to bear in the past. He's on the outs now. We've got a lot of people, you know, various legal troubles that have pursued a lot of people in the administration, whether through the Mueller investigation or other things. Who in Trump's orbit does he trust fully that he would just never eject from it for any reason?
So I think if
anyone,
like Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump.
So the family. Yeah.
He thinks they can only trust his family and that everyone else is just trying to profit off him or, you know, that those people are not going to be with him on his side forever. And so, but even he has criticized his own family members in front of them and in front of other people, sometimes suggesting, Washington is such a tough place. Why don't you move back to New York? He told Jared and Ivanka a couple times. And so, and they haven't, everyone expected them, you know, at every school year, people are wondering, are they going to come back? But they love being in the mix. They think that they're doing a good job on their issues. In terms of other people, Kellyanne Conway seems to be a survivor. Stephen Miller, people who really believe in Trump, or at least do everything in their power to stay on his good side. Mm. And in Kellyanne's case, George Conway, her husband, has been a kind of a headache because he's always criticizing the president. Those people are kind of the people who are going to be left standing. Trump turns on many other people if they remotely start to criticize him, like we saw Anthony Scaramucci recently.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up the Trump criticizing Barrack and others as trying to make a buck off him. He thinks as we've seen in his interactions, he's more than happy while these people are close to him, while they're his friends, to allow them to make a buck off him. And that seems to be just he seems to view as part of the friendship. But once it goes by the wayside, it becomes a point of complaint.
And there's a quote from our story. I think it's from a senior administration official saying, Trump never got any of that money that Barrack was raising, the $107 million. And then we thought about it more. And actually, Trump made more than $1.5 million to the Trump Hotel that they were spending money on. And so if you gave to the inauguration, maybe if, you know, 1.5 million out of $107
million, tied up.
That's 1% of your money is going to Trump. And so he's profiting. He profited off the inauguration. And so we had to kind of add a line after that quote saying, well, actually, he did profit off this.
Oh, and Daniel, before we let you go, I have to bring this up just because it's such an interesting story from the point of view of audio, but you had another story recently about basically the defining imagery of the Trump presidency, and it's him.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't happy with
standing on the lawn of the White House with Marine One flapping or whirring or whatever you want to call it in the background, and this awful whine and him shouting over it.
Yes, I've never been a fan. You know why? I don't like paying.
So Stephen Colbert dubbed it Chopper Talk. And so we put that in the headline of our story. He loves to mix it up with the media and journalists before he's about to board Marine One. And he will pontificate on every subject under the sun. But it's also very – I talked to a lot of the reporters who cover the White House, and it's very hard for them to get substantive questions in. And you can't really do a follow-up. He just goes to the next person.
You're competing with a helicopter, Jack.
And so he's done around 80 of these in the last 2.5 years, whereas President Obama only did 3 of these. And that's according to Mark Noller, who keeps the statistics on this. Obama, I talked to people around him, and he liked to do the formality with the
press
lectern,
conference, the
podium.
Yeah.
And Trump, they don't really have daily briefings anymore. They haven't had that in, I think, 5 months under Stephanie Grisham, who there was some talk maybe they would bring them back. But no, this is Trump's preferred way of kind of shouting at the press. He loves seeing them mix it up, and he sometimes can leave them waiting in, you know, 80-degree heat for half an hour as he finishes his business to talk to them. But you also get access, and so that's the case that Trump's defenders were making, that he's done more of these, and he talks to the press on a regular basis, and so that they can get their take. But also, I've talked to people around Trump, and they said on certain days they would tell him, maybe this is not a good day to engage. We don't want to give more fuel to a certain story, and he would engage anyway.
Can we do one of them indoors?
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us to talk through your story.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And as always, a big thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in this week. Our producer for this episode is Jenny Ament. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.
I think they're really full of shit, political strategists.
Many of them are. What they tell journalists.
Who do you think is more full of shit, political strategists or economists? I actually feel like it's a toss-up.
That is a tough one.
It's a toss-up.